Blog Talk Radio. Don't be afraid to care. Leave, but don't leave me. Look around, choose your own ground. Long you live and high you fly. Smiles you give and tears you cry. All you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be. Run, rabbit, run. Dig that hole. The work is done. Don't sit down. It's time to dig another one. Long you live and high you fly. Only if you ride the tide. Balance on the biggest wave. Forget the sun. When at last the work is done, don't sit down. It's time to dig another one. Long you live and high you fly.
I want to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. We have a special guest. Alvin Taylor is our guest on John Talk Radio tonight. This is our September the 27th episode. Alvin, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, John. How are you?
You know, I'm doing really good. It's a beautiful day here in Central Ohio. It's fall setting in, so it's really nice. But I appreciate you joining the show tonight, Alvin.
I'm excited about it. What a privilege, what a pleasure, and what an honor it is. Excuse the background noise. I'm actually at a USC, the Trojans football game, and enjoying an opportunity this weekend with my family, and I'm really actually enjoying this. So I'm really excited about being on this show right now. So please forgive me and excuse the background noise. I hope you're able to hear okay.
Yeah, I can hear fine.
And,
So what we want to talk about, it's really my passion, talk music, Alvin, and I've had this show for about 6 years and talked to a lot of musicians in the world, and I could just talk music and just love the history of rock and roll and this country's, you know, Americana music, how it's grown from, you know, over the years from blues and everything. And it's such a great thing to have you on the show. Now, what I'd like the listeners to know about Alvin Taylor and how it started with you. I mean, you've drummed with all the greats. You've had a great career. You're just an amazing musician. How did it all start off for you, Alvin? How did the whole love for music and getting started with music?
Interviewer.
Well, actually, I started out playing drums in Little Richard's band when I was 14 years old. I was discovered in a nightclub. Actually, not a nightclub. I was working as a busboy at the Biltmore Hotel in Palm Springs, California, when Little Richard, Billy Preston, Sammy Davis Jr., and Frank Sinatra all walked in at the same time when I was playing and watched me playing drums. They were all kind of like pretty much blown away at that time. And next thing I know, I ended up in Las Vegas at the International Hotel, opening up the show for Las Vegas in an 18-piece band, orchestra with Little Richard, with Jimi Hendrix playing guitar in our band, and Billy Preston playing keyboards, and that's how it all started for me.
Now, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing. I mean, when I talk to people about stories, to you, that, you know, that's something that you've talked about a lot, Alvin, that's part of your life, but that's such an amazing thing. I mean, what did you think when you saw those guys walk into the club? And that, I mean, that had to be a little intimidating right there.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. One more time.
Yeah, I was just wondering how it felt to see Little Richard and Sammy Davis Jr., you know, walking into the club you were in. I mean, how did that feel at that time?
Well, to be honest, I really had no idea who Little Richard was, nor Billy Preston. I was only 13 years old, coming up on 14. On my 14th birthday, Little Richard, to me, I thought he was maybe some Indian chief because he had all these feathers hanging from his head, and he had like kind of like a headrest type of a thing and all this makeup and stuff. So I really wasn't really sure who he actually was. I knew he was someone that was important, so I thought that maybe he was just one of the local Indian chiefs because I actually grew up on the Indian reservation in Palm Springs. And someone said that that was Little Richard, but I knew, obviously, who Frank Sinatra was, and I knew who Sammy Davis Jr. were. And they were pretty much regulars that came in and out of various different restaurants and business organizations and places around the Palm Springs area in the desert. So I saw them all the time, and it wasn't really that much of a big deal. But when I stopped to think about it, to actually see them in the restaurant area while I was playing, it was kind of a little intimidating, but at the same time exciting because I knew that they would like what I was doing.
Yeah, I love that story. I mean, that's just such, so intense. And you're 13. At 13 years old, Alvin, that had to be pretty amazing. Now, take us from the beginning when you started. How did you get interested in playing the drums from the very beginning?
Well, from the very, very beginning, I recall being about 7 and a half, almost 8 years old, my parents taking me to a parade. They'd have a couple of parades in the local city, local parades. One was called the Desert Circus Parade, where they would have this big circus that would come to town in Palm Springs, and they would have what was called the Desert Rodeo Parade, where they had this big rodeo, were a bunch of cowboys and, you know, roping the cows and that sort of stuff, bull riding festivals for the rodeo. And each year they would have these two parades, and I got lucky. My parents took me to one of the parades, and I was sitting there anticipating what was about to happen when all of a sudden this thunderous roar of a sound that seemed like miles down the road. I could look and hear them, but I could not really see. But I just heard this amazing thunder. And as it got closer, it became more distinctive that the sound was in my ear, and it was actually drummers that were huddled together and marching with this band, with this guy out in front with a big, big tall hat, and he had a whistle, and he was blowing these kind of like rhythmic type of sounds on the whistle. And the drummer goes, I was like, oh my goodness. And I thought to myself, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to play drums. And so I followed them, and before I knew it, I'd gotten lost. As they were marching down the road, I was so intrigued and so excited and so amazed at what they were doing. I would just follow alongside them on the sidewalk and watching them. And I just knew by the end of the parade that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I remember talking to some of the drummers and them letting me kind of like take the sticks in my hand and play on their drums. That's how it all started for me. That's what really excited me and gave me a clue that that was my call.
So from that point on, Alvin, how did you go forward from there? I mean, did you buy a drum kit? How did it all work so that, like, you're 7 and a half, 8 years old, you're completely blown away by the drummers? What happens at that point? Do you get a drum kit? I mean, how does it work from there?
Well, I didn't buy a drum kit or get a drum kit immediately. I sort of made my own kit because family really wasn't financially able at that time. My dad had a job as a carpenter, and he was just starting to build his own company in Palm Springs as a construction person, as a carpenter, and they didn't have much money at the time. So I sort of built my own kit out of cardboard boxes and found various different items to kind of make the sounds that kind of like would resemble a drum set. And I kind of made my own drum set and kind of played on them for a while, and until people were looking and seeing, wow, this kid is really amazing. We better get him a drum set. And so my the neighbor was, in fact, saying, you know what, I'm going to buy you a drum set. My parents took that as an insult. You know what? Hey, if you ever want to make your neighbors mad, buy their kids a drum set.
Oh, that's funny.
That's what some neighbors did, you know, and they made my parents mad. But then once my parents began to realize that there was a calling and there was something unique and something different for me as a drummer, and as I began to play, I was invited in different areas of the community to participate as a drummer. I recall going to a church once with my mother, and the drummer that was playing got caught up in the spirit. Next thing you know, he was floating down the aisleway as the rest of the musicians continued to play. And I was like, man, this is my opportunity. So I jumped on the drum set, and he immediately started playing drums. And he's caught up in the spirit. I'm playing the drums. And so after church, the next thing I know is all these people were coming up to me saying to my mom, man, your kid's really got talent. What an amazing kid. He is an amazing kid. These things, I mean, I heard it and didn't think much of it, but there was something that felt good about the compliments. And it really encouraged me to know that, wow, maybe I really do have some talent. And that's where it started.
So, Alvin, when you talk to young drummers and people that are musicians that are starting out, what are some of the basic things that you tell them as a drummer, you know, that you can share with young drummers and young people that are getting started in? What are some of the most important things that you could share with people?
Well, the first thing I say is never give up your dream. Never give up your hope about your talent. You can make it. There's absolutely nothing that you can't accomplish. There's absolutely nothing that you can't do. And don't let anybody discourage you. If you have a dream, if you have an objective, if you have a goal, make a plan and stick to it, and you can be very successful.
Now, when you were, like, okay, you're starting, you get the drum kit, you're playing, 18 years old, Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr., they see you, they, okay, let's go on tour. You're 14 years old. At that point, was there back from your parents saying, wait a minute, that's not going to work? I mean, when you were that young to go on tour with these guys, was that easy to do? And when you look back, does it seem real?
I'm sorry, you're fading out and I can't hear you. I'm distracted by something here that's not happening. You're fading in and out.
Oh, I'm sorry. So when you were starting out and getting on the road, what was it like when you first started playing on the road, Alvin, with Billy Preston and you were, Hendrix was in the. What was that like at that young age?
Well, it was just a new experience for me altogether. It was just something very different. I knew that this was what I needed to do. I knew that it was a calling, nevertheless, regardless of my age. Playing with Jimi Hendrix was one of the most amazing things that ever happened in my life. Playing with Billy Preston was absolutely amazing. The thing is that when I first got involved with playing with these guys before before it was agreed that I would actually go on the road, my mother didn't want me involved because I was only 14 years old. And
right.
For me to play in the band at that age, she didn't really want to allow that. And her main concern was my school. She wanted me to make sure that I had a good education and that things went well for me in school. And so she was actually not wanting me to go. And Little Richard, not wanting to be outdone, had his manager, Bunce Blackwell, to talk with my mom and address all of her concerns in regards to me going on the road and playing. One of the concerns was that I would have a bodyguard, that I would have a tutor on the road with me, that I would have adjoining suites, that I would fly first class with Little Richard wherever he went, and that I wouldn't be left on a bus with a bunch of band members that would not be as responsible. So that's one of the things that kind of happened to me, and that was kind of interesting knowing that they would go out of their way to really make amendments or accommodations for me and to make it happen so that it would work not only in the group's favor but also my favor and also at the same time to satisfy my mom.
Now, how was it, Alvin, when you were playing with Jimi Hendrix and Billy Preston and Little Richard? How did you learn the different drum styles? Because there's a lot of different musical things going on there between those guys. And how did you learn to adapt to that? And were there mentors that you had that you learned from back then?
Oh, absolutely. I listened to a lot of various different drummers. I listened to a lot of records at that time. One of my favorite drummers, believe it or not, was Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder played drums. As good as he played keyboards or as good as he sang.
Wow.
And he played on a lot of records back in the day. And so I listened to those records, and when I found out that he was actually the drummer on those, I pretty much kind of listened and kind of adapted a style that was unique and different, a style that was my own. So that's basically how I began to kind of establish my own unique style. It's just from listening to what others were doing and sort of using a bit of that as a foundation and then adding my own flavor.
Yeah, and I didn't know Stevie Wonder played the drums, so that's pretty cool. I have to go back and listen to that. But
yes.
That's amazing. And it kind of makes me think about a question that I had out about quite a few drummers, a bass player, and interviewing bass players and drummers. There's a lot in common there. But when you play the drum, such a physical thing to do, but it's also a very mental thing, and it also is spiritual because of the beat and everything. I look at a drummer as having to do a lot of things. How do you break that down when you're drumming and you know that it's a physical thing, but there's a mental part, and then there's the spiritual part? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it's just a matter of listening. You know, to me, the whole thing has to do with perception. You perceive a specific sound, a specific element of spiritual blend or a spiritual direction that's taking place, and you try to adapt to developing a character on spot. to go with that. A lot of times, you know, movies and television shows, they have a script to follow. And a lot of times music isn't always script that way. It's not always, well, this is the way it's going to go and that's how we do it. And a lot of times you don't have an opportunity to practice and to get a concept or an idea of how a song goes. Some of the things are created right on the spot. And in order to be in line and in tune with that, you have to have a real open mind and a open heart and some type of an insight spiritually to see what direction it should go in. So I just kind of listen with my heart and try to develop some type of a character that fits in and offers a foundation for the direction that the music is being shaped to go in.
Now, what's your, of all the genres of music, Alvin, that you play, what's your favorite to play? Is it rock? Is it jazz? Is there anything that you like playing like more than others, or do they all kind of fit the same way?
Well, I've learned to be very versatile, and I like all types of music. But I would say that my favorite is rock and roll, and basically I'm known as a rock and roll drummer. I know with a name like Alvin Taylor and working with a lot of the English groups, George Harrison, playing drums with Elton John, and a lot of the English groups, I developed this character as an English drummer, and I remember coming to California and to work with some of the R&B groups. A lot of them didn't want to accept me. I remember wanting to do some work with Barry White and leaving a message at his office, and they were like, well, you know what, we don't really do rock and roll. We're into R&B, and it's like, you know, just kind of a difficult situation where they didn't know that I could play R&B as well. And also, the strange thing is that they didn't know that I was a black guy, and they thought that I was actually, you know, an English guy because of the name and because of the fact that I had worked with very, very
wow.
different English artists before.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So let's for the listeners and for my own education, Alvin. Okay, so you're touring with Little Richard. What happens after that? Where do you go from there?
Where did I go from there, or where do
yeah.
I go from there?
Yeah.
You're asking me right.
Yeah.
So you're
curious.
Saying in my life and in my career right now, where do I go?
No, I'm curious about where you were back then and how you progressed then. Where did you go in your career after the touring with Little Richard?
Well, after that, I started getting various different calls. Of course, I had met a lot of various different people in the industry. Give me a second. I need to plug in. My battery is going dead. I want to make sure my phone doesn't go dead on air here. Okay, yeah. As I was saying, basically, I had met a lot of people, people that wanted me to play with them, and I just begin to just do various different things, get different offers. For instance, Eric Burden had heard about me. He wanted me to play drums in the Eric Burden band. And during a lot of time that I actually had available and off during our rehearsals and our time to work together as musicians, what had happened is that there were other producers that had taken notice of me and wanted me to make records for them. For instance, a producer by the name of Frank Wilson did a lot of Motown stuff and invited me to work with the Jacksons, Michael Jackson collectively, Jermaine Jackson, and not only collectively, but independently to work with each one of the various different artists. Motown, Marvin Gaye, and Stevie Wonder, and a lot of other artists. So I started doing independent work as a studio drummer for various different groups. I mean, you name it, Bill Withers, Natalie Cole, and then thus my career was born, and I began to be acknowledged as one of the premier drummers in the business that could actually make records. And so when people would hear a record and it became a hit record, they were looking at, well, who are the people that were involved that actually made the record a hit record? And so they would look on the back of an album cover and they'd see my name. So they go, well, let's try to use the same formula because the song that we're doing is kind of like that. And they would include me. And next thing I know, I end up becoming one of the first call drummers as a session drummer in the Los Angeles entertainment industry for music.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Now, I think I read where you were on the first Saturday Night Live. Is that correct?
I did do the very first Saturday Night Live show with Billy Preston. yes, absolutely.
Now, that's pretty amazing. Talk about that.
Well, it's interesting. George Carlin was the host. I got a chance to meet him. I didn't know who he was, but I know he was the host, and he was supposed to be a guy who was supposed to be very funny. And so I got invited by Billy to play drums for him. It was Billy Preston and two of the members from a group called Rufus. And
oh, yeah.
Bobby Watson was the bass player, and Tony Maiden was a guitarist. And then we invited the group Tower of Power, the horn section, to play horns for us in the background. And we had also a writer who was a guitarist by the name of Steve Beckmeyer, who played with Greg Allman and Cher and wrote some songs for Earth, Wind & Fire. So it was an amazing group, an amazing opportunity to work with Billy Preston at this on this particular project, opening up the very first ever filmed Saturday Night Live show.
Yeah, that's
1974.
Would it have that in like a film video that you can watch? Would probably be cool to watch again.
I'm sorry, you were fading in and out. One more time, could you say it again?
Yeah, have you been able to watch it since then? I mean, a film of it or a video of it?
You know what? Yeah, I occasionally you know what? I'll be very honest with you. I have not had a chance to actually sit down and see the whole show in its entirety. I have seen bits and pieces of it because some of the fans that I have posted it on their Facebook walls and say, hey, check out my friend Alvin Taylor, or my favorite drummer Alvin Taylor, Billy Preston, Saturday Night Live, the very first Saturday Night Live ever from 1974. And of course, you know, when you see your name, it kind of draws interest, but a lot of times I'm so busy I don't really have a chance to really see a lot of stuff or read. I mean, I know recently they had an article on me and Modern Drummer magazine, which I've gotten hundreds of calls, literally, from people saying, oh, man, this amazing article on you in Modern Drummer magazine. I believe they have like 100 million viewers and about 10 million subscribers to that magazine. So a lot of people are seeing me, and there's a lot of exposure. And I get these calls, but yet and still, I'm so busy, I haven't had a chance to actually sit down and read the whole article. I kind of like looked at a couple of pages I wanted to see the pictures, make sure that my pictures were okay, that my hair was in place, that I looked okay, and that kind of stuff. But
that's wild.
Actually reading the articles in its entirety, or even seeing Saturday Night Live, the whole show in its entirety, I've only been able to visit a few bits and pieces of it.
Now, that's 1974. So let's talk about that you had. You went to England and worked with in England with a different artist, Alvin. I know that you worked with George Harrison. Now, is it true that you lived at his house and his studio there?
Yes, I did. I lived at in Friar Park. On Henley on Thames, which was George's castle that he had there at the time. I actually lived on the premises and recorded out of Friar Park Studio. with George, under George Harrison's direction, along with a producer and a friend of ours, a saxophonist by the name of Tom Scott.
Oh, wow, yeah. So, Alvin, people that are interested in how George was, how the whole...
You know what, I missed the last part of that.
How was it to work? I think people would be interested, Alvin, to know, like, to work with in that whole frequency.
Give me a second. I need to get to another location.
Okay.
You're breaking up in this a kind of a wind that's coming up. Like I said, I'm out here at a USC game, football game, and it's kind of windy now. And
yep.
I think the wind is distracting me. Give me a second. Okay, now repeat the question one more time.
I fans interested out know what. I mean, that's a pretty amazing situation to go there to a person's castle. What was he like to work with?
Oh, amazing. Just an absolutely amazing person. George is probably the nicest guy I ever met in my life. Very pleasant, extremely humble person. And he knew how to make people feel special. He knew how to make people feel important. He knew how to make people feel like they were concerned for, and that he had a concern and a care for them. And George was there to simply be of service and to meet your needs, for you to give your best. And he certainly displayed and showed all qualities of a great host, a loving, very generous, very kind individual, human being. In fact, I can say that as a direct result of knowing George Harrison, my life is better.
Wow, that's awesome. What was it like working with, like, I mean, how would, like, the sessions before you would go in and start recording? How much preparation? How did you know what he wanted? I mean, how did that whole thing happen, Alvin?
Well, actually, George... was the kind of guy that would make sure that you wouldn't have to guess anything, but that you would actually know specifically what it was that he was requiring or what it was that he was looking for. And in my case, what George did was he sat down with me with a 12-string guitar in the front of a fireplace in the castle in his living room, and begin to give me a rundown of each song. And as he played each song that we were going to record on the album, he would give me a rundown, and he would talk to me about the character that he wanted for each song and what I should look at portraying. So it was not like I was left in the dark. I had good direction. I had amazing concepts from George, and a good clue about what it was exactly that he wanted. But he never told me exactly what to play. He told me that the reason that he got me acquired my service or acquired the skills that I have, he wanted me to, the reason that he had hired me basically was because of what he knew that I was capable of doing. So he would kind of give me an idea of basically about certain concepts and ideas of things that he wanted on that album. So we never really sat down and rehearsed the songs. Well, here's the verse. This is what the verse is going to sound like. And when we get to the chorus, I want to hear what you're going to play there. It was never like that. He would just say that, okay, this is what the chorus is going to sound like. This is what we're going to come out of the chorus. We're going to go right back to the verse, and then we're going to do a little interlude. And then he just would explain the formula from beginning the form of the song. And that was basically it. I'd have to fill in all the spaces.
Kirby, they're here.
Yeah, that has to be just an amazing thing. So were you? When you were in the recording studio with George, was he like real Did you do a lot of different takes on or Alvin, or was it pretty much how did that work? I drum tracks and would he come back and review that, and how did that work?
Well, I think the most takes that we ever did was probably two. It's possible that that if I didn't remember correctly, that we may have done the most takes would have been three takes on any given song. But for the most part, most of the songs were all one-take songs. It was sit down, this is the idea, this is the concept, okay, let's play it through once. We'll play it through once, and then we go, okay, let's record. We record it, then we go in and take a listen to it to see collectively what it was like, and did we think we made any mistakes, did we hear anything that we could improve. And everybody was saying, hey, I think it's great. It's good. And George was like, I agree. This is awesome. There's nothing more needed. And that was basically it.
Now, who was the bass player in those sessions? Do you remember?
Absolutely. I'll never forget Willie Weeks.
Oh, yeah.
He's playing with Eric Clapton.
How important is it? Like, you know, the connection between the drummer and the bass player. When you're playing with somebody like Willie Weeks, who are some of the other bass players that you remember, Alvin, that were just amazing to play with?
Oh, my God. Boy, a lot of great bass players. Reggie McBride is an amazing bass player. A guy by the name of Tinny Burke, who was known as a member and a brother of the brothers of the group, the Five Stair Steps, also known as the Stair Steps. Then there's a guy by the name of Scott Edwards. There's a guy that's, I don't know if he's actively involved in the business like he used to be, but certainly an amazing bass player by the name of David Shields. Then there's Wilton Felder. I could go on. There's tons of amazing bass players, but these are some of the great bass players that I've played with. And another amazing bass player is a guy by the name of Leland Sklar, who's known as a bass player for the section. He's played with everybody from James Taylor to Carole King to the section, a group called the Section, which was a rhythm section that had Russ Kunkel playing drums and Danny Kuchmar and Clarence McDonald playing keyboards. Amazing bass player, indeed, and I could probably name 100 more. And if any of you are listening and I didn't mention your name, please forgive me, but
just mention
some of the ones that really blew my mind.
Well, Alvin, let's talk a little bit about the way that the music industry and the music scene is today compared to the way it was back in the 60s and 70s. What do you think some of the big major changes have been since you played back in the 60s and 70s and the business side of it and you know, being a session musician and learning how you had to learn the business side in order to succeed? What do you think some of the biggest differences is for a musician in 2014 as it was back then?
Well, you know, today, you know, you don't really have to be, per se, an accomplished musician. You just have to have some type of an ear and being able to know how to manipulate. For instance, a lot of things are done electronically. A lot of things are done by programs, which means that if you take a part and you like that part, rather than play the part, you know, for 4 bars or 8 bars or 16 bars, you just, you know, you play it for a count of 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you just take it and loop it and repeat it. So you don't have to play things the way that we used to play them anymore. As long as you come up with an idea of something that you like, you can make it work electronically. You can make it work technically from a technical point of view. You don't have to really play it. So, you know, today it's not, the world is not full of great players, but we have great producers that know how to take and manipulate sound and make it sound like people are actually playing, when in reality it's just pieced together music.
Now, do you think that's a good thing, Alvin, or a bad thing?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing.
Yeah, it's just the way things have gone. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
just the way that it is. You know, the drum machines came in, and I can't say that's a good thing or a bad thing. People do what they need to do to make things work the way they desire and want it to work. And whether it works for them from a business point of view or from a musical point of view, it doesn't really seem to matter, just as long as it works for them, you know? And that's just the way it is. And I'm not one to take and point the accusatory finger and talk condescendingly towards what someone is or is not doing. Anybody who's making an effort to make music, my hat's off to them.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenging profession, but it's such an incredibly rewarding profession that you've had. Now, one question I'd like to ask Alvin, we just have about 10 more minutes left. Out of the tours that you've been on and supporting musicians, and which ones are the ones that stand out to you the most that are special to you? Some of the tours that you were on.
Some of the tours that I was on.
Right.
You're asking me which ones were the most impressive to me?
Yeah, and the ones that stood out to you.
Well, I did a tour with a friend of mine when we were breaking the record, You Make Me Feel Like Dancing and When I Need You, by a guy by the name of Leo Sayer.
Right.
And I remember after we had gotten involved with the tour, we decided to have some T-shirts made up called The Endless Tour, because the next album that he had coming out was called The Endless Flight. And on the Endless Flight album, there were some pretty good songs that were recorded and done. And so the tour was kind of a promotion to kind of keep people aware of what was to come next for Leo Sayer, which was The Endless Flight. But the tour was so long, we ended up calling the tour The Endless Tour. So we had these T-shirts made up called The Endless Tour. And, it was really great. I learned a lot. The keyboardist, Nicky Hopkins, I don't know if you know who he is.
Absolutely.
He was playing keyboards for us. We had Rolling Stones saxophonist by the name of Bobby Keys playing saxophone with us.
That's a pretty good band.
We also had Steve Madeo, the trumpet player who played on Superstition for Stevie Wonder. And he played on a lot of other great stuff, an amazing trumpetist by the name of Steve Madeo. Oliver C. Brown from Casey and the Sunshine Band, the percussionist playing percussion. And also Reggie McBride playing bass, and a guitarist who was also a producer that produced Eric Carmen and Rod Stewart by the name of Richie Zito. And this was an amazing band to be a part of. We had a couple of background singers, females, that were very well known as well. And Leo was a gentleman, and he was definitely a showman. And it was just fun working with him, because he was like just fun to watch working. He would make you want to work as you would look up front and see him moving and dancing, and it just really kind of made you really want to put some fire behind him so that he would be encouraged to even do the very best that he could do even more. So that was probably one of the best tours that I had ever been on. Besides a tour that I did with Eric Burden, I also loved working with Eric Burden. We had a band called the Eric Burden Band right after the group War. Eric Burden and War broke up, and War went on their own. Eric Burden also became a solo artist and put together his own band with myself and a guy by the name of Alon, who was a guitarist, and a bass player named Randy Rice. And we went out. We were support group for what was the name of the band? I just can't think of the name of the band right now. Grand Funk Railroad was the name of the band.
Wow.
And yeah, they were doing a live album, and so we were opening up the show for them, and that was a real fun show too, because got to meet a lot of people and found out what a really wonderful and amazing talent Mark Farner was, and he took us to his house in Ann Arbor, Michigan, took us to his ranch. We got a chance to ride horses, eat some of mom's home cooking, and just kind of like live like a family while we're out on the road at the same time. You know, it's one thing to eat hotel food and go to restaurants, and but then when you're laying over at someone's home and you're resting and, you know, you're kind of like having a family-style life and riding horses and doing all the normal things that, you know, people do as a family. And then that same night, you know, getting in a limo and riding to a gig, it's a whole different concept than just getting out of an airplane, going to the hotel, leaving from the hotel, from the limos to the gigs. So those two tours were two of the most memorable tours, besides working for Little Richard opening up the show for Elvis Presley at the International Hotel with Jimi Hendrix playing guitar in the band as Jimmy
wow.
James. No one knew him really as Jimi Hendrix, even though he had had an album out and was doing well. But was just sort of getting off the ground at that time. And I don't want to fail to mention the most amazing keyboardist in the world, Billy Preston, at that time, who was alive and working with us.
Well, Alvin, it's been great talking to you. I really appreciate you. I know you're a very busy person, and your history in music is just incredible. And I just want to thank you for taking your time tonight to be on. Would you like to talk about any current projects or anything that you're doing right now?
Well, yeah, I'm working with a group called Alon and the Funk Factory. Many people might remember, as I said before, Alon was a guitarist with me while I was in the Eric Burden Band. And just when the Eric Burden Band broke up, Alon went on his own as a solo artist and asked me to play drums on his album called Cream City. And we had a hit record called Rock and Roll Gangster. And
okay.
That record
yep.
is still being played around the world and a very popular song, especially amongst the oldies. They call it oldies but goodies.
Right, yeah.
There's a guy named Art LeBeau who has a show here, and he doesn't even do a show without playing that song on his radio show. Anyway, Alon and I, after all these years, decided to get back together and form a group. And so Alon and I actually have a group called Alon and the Funk Factory. And that section, by the way, is we have a guy by the name of Mark Gumberg who does all of the, who in the past did Aaron Spelling's television music. He was an arranger and helped put the music scores together for a lot of the productions and television shows. And Reggie McBride, bass player, also plays with the Eagles, is in our band. And we have, again, Steve Beckmeyer, who's playing guitar with Alon, also, who's also a guitarist and vocalist. Steve Beckmeyer is playing guitar. He also, like I said before, wrote songs for Earth, Wind, and Fire, and was in Greg Allman and Cher's band and wrote songs for them as well. That band is going to be playing at a place called Fantasy Springs on October 3rd and 4th in the desert area in California. And India. Second time playing there. And pretty much things are great with that band. There was a, I did have a group with a guy by the name of J.P. Cervani called Hendrix's Gypsies, but that's a thing of the past. That band, I just have a big R.I.P., rest in peace, Hendrix's Gypsies, even though the name and the band might continue, but it will certainly continue without me because I don't really choose to be a part of some of the things that have taken place there, and that's where I'm at right now.
Alvin, thank you, and I really appreciate it, and I just wish you the best.
It's a privilege, an honor, and a pleasure. Thank you so much, John, for having me on.
Thank you, Alvin, and I want to just thank everyone for listening to radio tonight, and we'll be back next week. Alvin, you be safe, and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you, John.
of you I've known in my life. Never had my video done.
Well, of course, my dad.